Did you know that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day? But don't take my word for it. Actually, you should take my word for it. And here's what you need to do. You need to go to ZipRecruiter.com/Zach. That's www.ZipRecruiter.com/Zach to learn more there about recruiting the best people for your business. The fastest, best people fast. You know that fast, good, cheap pyramid? Well, this is doing it all. This is fast, good, and yeah, you got to check out the pricing online. That's kind of above my pay grade, but ZipRecruiter, check it out. Too many ads. Here we go.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
Episode 66, Tracy Gershon, who has really done it all, actually. She has been a publisher, a manager, a label A&R. She is judged on a reality show. She's also an advocate for women in country music. Let me tell you something. I think that Nashville is a better town with Tracy in it. And you know what? I don't say that about that many people, actually. I think we actually lose a couple people in this town, to be quite honest. No, I'm joking. There's a lot of great people in Nashville, but Tracy really stands above many of them. And I mean, she's signed some of the biggest acts in the format. We're gonna reveal those in this episode. I don't want to give anything away, but here we go. Episode 66, Tracy Gershon. Let's dive in. Tracy, how do you get the gig at Nashville Star? Because you were working for Sony at the time. I feel like as an executive, you got enough going on. You probably don't need to go do a crazy competition show. How do you get roped into it? Who pulls you in?
Oh my gosh. You know, I have to say, when it was one of these things that they came up with. I mean, Sony, I guess, signed on to it. And I was the new kid on the block. I'm not kidding. I was the new kid on, it was like, give it, the listeners may not know this commercial. Do you remember Mikey? Give it to Mikey. Do you remember that old commercial?
Yeah.
That Mikey would eat
Give it absolutely.
I think I was Mikey. Nobody wanted to touch it. Give it to Tracy. You know, I was like, okay. And I didn't know what it was. You know, it was, you know, American Idol had just started. I was just like, oh. And I said, you know, and I really had signed on just to be the talent advisor. You know, the record company, we were going to be the recipient of whoever won, and we would make, you know, a record with them. And so they just literally gave you figure it out. And I met the showrunner and the director, and I literally didn't know anything about country music. We went to Austin, and I made him pay, you know, buy like $1,000 worth of records. And I really liked the guy. He was cool. And the truth is, I did not want to be a judge. They asked me to be a judge. I said, absolutely not. There's no way I was going to do it. And they kept asking me, and we kept thinking of different people, because I literally thought, I don't want to show my ass. Like, you know, I don't want to be on TV. Like, it's not, no, I want to be behind the scenes. And this is a true story. My kids had just gotten into a private school, and I got the tuition bill, and I was like, oh my gosh. So I called back.
Sign me up for the show.
I did. I go, does this pay extra? And so, and they did. And, you know, I have to say, I was so nervous about doing it. And like the day before we left, because I didn't know what it was going to be. And I was nervous about it, and I was talking, and this is a name dropping, but my dear friend, Emmy Lou Harris, who is the queen of integrity, I was telling her, I said, oh man, this is probably going to be the end of my career. And she said, you know what? You just go do it and make it better. And I went, oh, okay. And I kind of had her in my conscience when I did it and tried to do as best I can. And then it ended up being a blast. Honestly, it was so much fun. And, you know, found Miranda Lambert from it. So, you know, life is good.
So how did you, because in the first, I think it was the first two seasons, the judges were actually part of the elimination process. Like each episode, the judges would pick someone to get eliminated, and then the fans would pick someone to get eliminated, right? I never watched the show, but this is what I,
God, I'm trying to remember. It was, the first, God, this is going so back because it changed a lot. I think we did eliminate. Yeah, we eliminated. I mean, I go back. I was actually one of the judges. I actually did all the, I mean, I went on the road and did all the auditions. I mean, I was an associate producer on the show. I mean, I was the label. I was wearing the label hat too, and a judge hat. And I had to go out and do a lot of the auditions I think the judges, we all eliminated down to the top 12. And I think, honestly, I can't remember if we did the eliminations in the beginning and then it became fan eliminations.
Okay, so National Star, you're out doing the auditions and you freak out about Miranda Lambert, who did not win. And you actually felt she wasn't going to win. I think she came in like third, but you called the label head.
I hoped she wouldn't win. So it was really funny. I saw her original audition in, I can't remember if it was Houston or Dallas now. And it was the first time ever, like this, you know, that weird about that thing about, oh, the camera loves somebody. You know, you hear that all the time. The director, I saw her, he said, come here. And he made me look through the camera and there was just a twinkle, like I saw it. And she was so awesome. And I remember thinking, when my boss at the time had said, hey, are you seeing anything good out there? And I said, I just saw this girl that I just love from day one. And so, you know, when she was going through it, you know, and she was going through, you know, whatever the show, I hoped that she didn't win because she wasn't quite ready. Like if she won, you know, the thing is you win and all of a sudden you're in the studio and it's fast and it's stuff and you don't really get the... You don't get some of the same benefits of when you know, getting your deal in the regular way. You get other benefits. But, and also, I think at the time, Clint Black was our mentor, and he was going to produce whoever won. And I knew he wasn't the right producer for her. Like, I kind of knew. So I was really hoping I knew I was going to sign her. Like, in my gut, I'm like, this is my kind of person. And so I did, and you know, and Frank Liddell produced a wonderful record on her, and the rest is history.
Wait, so she gets voted off the show, and then what happens? Do you reach out to her, what, the next day, or how does that work?
No, I think I had to wait till the end of the show. I mean, in those contracts, a lot of times you get the record label gets first right of refusal, whether it's the first top three or the top five. You know, I've seen all different iterations of this.
But you guys were the record label,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. So we got first right. I think there's a certain amount of time you have to sign them. So we had, you know, but she knew. I mean, her parents would sit behind me in the show. And every time she'd perform, I'd turn around and they'd wink at me and I'd wink at them because she did so good. And I just loved her. And she, I mean, that's a whole nother story that she's just such an incredible artist and was from day one, even when, you know, I met her when she was 18 and she always had a vision. I always knew who she was and knew what she wanted to do. It was great.
Absolutely. Okay, wait. So then how do you find Kacey Musgraves? Because didn't you find her through Miranda's mother?
Yes. Yeah, so Miranda's mother, Bev Lambert, who's just a hoot, turned out to be one of my secret A&R people because I just always have gravitated. For some reason, I've signed a lot of people from Texas. And that's just a great, you know, great music bed there.
Why is that a good stomping ground? Is it because there's just such a cultural...
Something in the water, man. They're just, it's attitude. It's just this great attitude. As if you say, you tell the Lamberts, you know, Lambert say, you can't say, I'm from Texas. You have to say, I'm from Texas with attitude. I think it's just attitude.
You've got to put a little
You've
attitude
You've got to put an attitude.
It.
But so... I became very close with Miranda's parents and they'd always call me and tell me about stuff they had seen. And I trusted them. There was always, you know, I always follow up on them. And then she called me because even though I wasn't a judge on Nashville Star, for some reason, I ended up always being involved in picking the talent or I was a consultant. And that year, because it wasn't our label, they wouldn't let me, if it went to a different label, my own label would not let me be a judge. You know, I guess, but Miranda's, mother had called me about Kacey because Bev's mother and I think it was Kacey's grandmother were really good friends. And so I got her audition tape and I was like, yeah, this girl, I mean, it was the same kind of thing. I thought, oh, she shouldn't win. She probably won't win, but she's good. And
she came in like
seventh.
Oh,
she came in seventh. Like she wasn't going to have any of this show. Her attitude was like, uh-uh. But when she moved to Nashville, I gave her her first publishing deal. I mean, and she was the first, when I went to go work at Warner Chappell, she was my very first signing. Because I knew, again, she had that little spitfire attitude that I loved, you know. And so, again, she's doing pretty well, I'd say.
So what's the secret? Because, I mean, even last season of American Idol, I had a ton of friends who went and auditioned. A lot of people were asking me if they thought I should go. I was like, I don't know what you should do. I mean, you figure it out. But I mean, I tried to give them advice, tried to talk through with them. But what's the secret? Because nobody, I mean, did Chris Young, how far did he make it on Nashville Star?
I think he won. I think he did. And it's funny, he would not do the show. The first 2 years I asked him to do the show and he would not do it.
He wouldn't do it. So there are exceptions to the rule, but how do you know if one of these shows is for you? Do they give you that platform? With Miranda and Casey, I guess it connected the dots, but so many get lost in these shows. Are these shows really the move?
No, I don't. You know, it's hard. I think in the beginning they were. They give you an audience, but I think you really have to. I think there's been so many of them, and it's been for so long that it's not like a sure thing. And I don't even know if that they get record deals anymore. It used to be you got a record deal. Now I don't even know if you get that. And I think Right. Now in the contracts, they don't have to put out the record. So I think now it's about that, you know, 30 days of fame and what you do with it and, you know, getting your socials up and all that. I mean, if you look at all the history of American Idol and The Voice, there's very few, the ratio, very few who have gone on to do something is small. But you know, like with, you know, for me as an A&R person, Miranda, you know, I really, you know, Miranda was just she was just an amazing artist. And, you know, for her, if you look at her, you go, she didn't want to do, you know, her mother made her do that show. She didn't want to do it. You know, she's just kind of too cool for that. And there was a couple artists that I had auditioned and I knew that it wasn't the right thing for them. They're, Hayes Carl, there's a guy, I don't know if you know who Hayes Carl is, a great artist. I did private auditions. That's the other thing is when I went out, I actually knew that some artists are not going to do that whole, you know, like stand in line for 8 hours. So I did some private auditions like in Austin in certain markets where I knew people and I would call club owners and say, hey, do you have anybody that's really good? So we did private auditions and Hayes was one of those guys and he was great and I wanted him on the show, but he said, you know, I just don't think this is for me. And I kind of went, you know what? I think you're right. So there are certain people not going to do. Aaron Watson was one too.
I love Aaron Watson.
Aaron Watson, I went after Aaron Watson. He goes, this is not for me. And I went, you know, okay. You know, I was just one of those. I didn't want to force anybody to do anything like that.
An amazing artist, Aaron Watson. One of my favorite artists of the Texas trade. One of my favorite artists. Okay. So Tracy, we've got so much to talk about here. I asked you to send me this list very last minute of the top five country albums to listen to that you have to listen to that represent country music. And here's the thing. I think there's something significant about these are the first ones that came to your head. So this is not a definitive list, but this is a list right here. And I think there's some great, and I put a list together too. So let's just start with the first one at the bottom. This is not in any order, but I just want to talk about this. Piece of the Sky, Emmylou Harris. This is my favorite Emmylou Harris record. I think this is the only Emmylou Harris record that I know intimately. But this is got a lot of rock in it. I think the opening song, Blueberry Wine, big rock guitar with James Burren playing a big like don't. I mean, very cool. Why this record? Why this kid? Just this came to you quick. Why this record?
Well, I mean, I have so much to say about this, and I hope you let me because you did that, and I was like just getting out of the shower. I'm like, what? I five? And first I was like, okay, it's always because I used to. Well, let's see. Let me answer that question first. Emmylou Harris, godmother to my children. My husband was a member of the Hot Band for years, but Emmy and my husband are the one who's taught me about country music.
Is that when you ask her to be your kid's godmother? Because you're serious about this. This is not like metaphorically. She actually is.
No, she's the godmother. She's the fairy godmother. Actual godmother.
Is there a lot of chutzpah to ask her to do that? Or are you pretty casual with her? Was it just like, hey?
No, she was just made sense. She sang at my dang wedding.
She was the one.
She was my wedding singer.
So if, God forbid, anything happened to you or her husband, your kids were going to be raised by Emmylou Harris? Is that what that means?
No, you know, they're the godmother. Actually, you know who was going to probably raise him was Allie Harnell, which is funny. She's the one that was in, you know, just because they're the godmother, they don't raise you because she was Emmy's on the road.
Okay,
no,
fine,
she's
fair.
Very close. My kids love her. She's been an amazing friend and guardian. And she taught me so much she was my teacher. But I think it's one of the, and that's one of the records that made me love country music too when I started listening because I was a rock kid. But, you know, you know, when you asked me that question, you know, my automatic answer, and this was, you know, I put in, you know, Swinging Doors, Merle Haggard.
Well, don't give them all away. Don't give them all away. We're going to get to them.
Talk about them.
We're going to get to them.
Can I give you the reason? But
no, we're
going to
get. We're going to go through each one. So okay.
Oh,
so Emmylou, Piece of the Sky. This record, this is a rock record to me. Well, here, talk about it. Keep talking about it.
Well, you see, there was like also, I think I had Sweethearts of the Rodeo, which is another pivotal kind of rock country record. There's just a lot of I don't know if I can talk to with the question, if I can talk to each individually. Individually, they're all just pivotal, just records that just defined, I think, the time and defined the genre in so many ways. Now I'm scared to say what go off my lips. Now you've made me
this,
nervous.
This record to me, because I remember studying guitar in college and I was very so I put a list together. So at the bottom of my list, but there's no order, I have the Buck Owens Live at Carnegie Hall concert,
that's
which to me
too.
Is such a great
that's
album.
That's right. See, Buck.
Great
my
album.
My cat was named Buck Owens. Come
see,
on.
My favorite, but I remember studying guitar in college and I was obsessed with that record. I learned every Don Rich lick on that record.
Yeah.
And I was saying to my guitar teacher, what's the next country album I should listen to? And he said Pieces of the Sky, Emmylou Harris, because the guitar playing on that record is incredible also.
Yeah.
So I then dove into that record. And for me, that record really got me into the whole 70s and into that lane of country, which to me, for me, it all starts with that record. I don't know if it really does, but for me, it actually does.
Well, again, I go back to, you know, I'm from Los Angeles. I didn't grow up in country music. I didn't even like, I made fun of country music. I literally did. I made fun of country music. I thought I was hokey. I didn't know anything about it. I meet my husband, who's a steel guitar player who plays with Emmylou Harris. I didn't even know, I had to ask, what's a steel guitar? I know that you're a steel guitar, but I didn't know. And then I did I went full on and learned everything. And between Emmy and Steve, they turned me on to, you know, well, I knew about the Burrito Brothers, but went into Lefty Frizzell and all these old stuff. And I go, these are all rock, like they're close to
these
rock music.
These are rock albums. These are very close.
I saw the thread and I just became so obsessed with it. And I started managing country acts. I mean, it was just a big awakening for me. And, you know, thus, you know, I've been my career in country music, but I didn't know, you know, I was a late bloomer, but man, and then also, you know, early on in my career as a concert promoter, and just going to age me because I think 120, but you know, I worked with Pretenders on their first tour, and all they wanted to do was go to the Palomino to see country western. And then I read about Bruce Springsteen and his favorite act was Hank Williams. And I kept going, all my rock heroes, like keep referring to these country guys. So, you know, it was all just led me there. And I went, this is the coolest stuff.
That's how I got into it too, because Jimmy Page, for example, talked a lot about how he was listening to Buck Owens, Don Rich, also the Beatles, and Roy Nichols, who was playing with Merle Haggard. Like it for me, I got into it through the rock guys, which is to me where it is. Okay, so you're living in LA, or you're from LA. You're like born and raised LA. We're gonna come back to this list, but you're born and raised LA. And what you're promoting concerts? And what's the story? We've talked about this, but for the record, what's the story where you funded your first record? You were managing
Rosie Flores.
Rosie Flores. Thank you. You were managing Rosie Flores. And she needed to make a record, and you had no money, and you decided to go on a game show to raise the funds for this project. What's the story here?
Was one of my first, again, after I fell in love with country music, and Rosie Flores was like the female Dwight Yoakam. She lives in Austin. She's like she's kind of a rockabilly. She's, you know, people know who she is. Amazing guitar player. And I used to see her shows, and one day she said, you want to manage me? I went, sure. I didn't even know what managing was. Sure, I'll manage you. Well, you know, we need money for a demo. Oh, that's me. Sorry. And I didn't have any money. My husband didn't have any, you know, he was my boyfriend at the time. We lived together. We didn't have any money, you know, and it was expensive. You couldn't just do it off your computer. You need to go into the studio and spend real money. And I was like, okay. And Steve's like, well, also, because he was a co-producer. He actually was co-producing the demo along with Howie Epstein, who's no longer with us, who was the bass player from Tom Petty.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. They loved country music. And I introduced them. That's another story, because I used to work for Tom Petty. But they wanted to produce this demo. So we had to figure out how to get money. So I'm literally looking at the LA Times, and I'm looking through, and it says auditions, game show. And I went, that's what I'll do. And my husband's like, what? And I go, no, I'll go on a game show. And he goes, that's ridiculous. I go, what? You don't think I can do it? So once you tell me not to do something, I'm going to go do it.
You're in.
So I dressed up in a really dumb outfit, like the dumbest outfit I could find. I put frost in, I had hairdo, went in there, jumped up and down like a chicken on a hot plate, you know, and told them I was a senior citizens aerobics instructor. And there I got on that show. And I won, I think we needed $1,500, and I think I won close to $1,800 and a set of luggage. So there you go.
Where's the luggage? Do you still have the luggage?
Oh, no. It didn't even have, you know, back then, I don't think it had wheels.
Wait, and then what was the game? How did you win?
Oh, my God. It was called Hot Streak. I think it was over here. It was a show that was from the UK, and the host was from the UK. And it was over for, it was here for one season, and it was like the show was like they put, it was a team, one team against another team. And it's hard to explain, but the host would give you a word. Y'all had headphones on, you couldn't hear. And he'd give the first person in line a word. He'd say like banana, and he'd go, okay. And he'd take your headphones. You'd have to give a clue to the next person. So they'd say banana, you know, let's say you'd say monkey. And they'd go, oh, banana. And then the next person takes off their headphones, but you can't repeat the same clue. So there's a strategy to it. But yeah, I got put with a bunch of women and they weren't so good. So I won most of the money, I have to say, in the bonus round. I made myself captain of the team, and I did the bonus round, which was quick thinking, which I'm good at. So that's management. Where we won most of our
this,
money. Yeah.
This is management. Masterclass in management here. Whatever it takes to get it done. You got to go on the game show. You got to raise the funds. This is it. Okay, so you get the funds. Is this record on Spotify? Can you listen to this record?
Oh, you know, probably.
What's the name of the record?
Yeah, it was on Warner Brothers. Oh, my God. It's terrible. Rosie Flores, looking at it on Spotify. I'm sure it is.
Wait, I've got right here. Rosie Flores. Okay,
she's
wait,
got a then, lot. What would her first one be?
From nine.
Oops. I could go in the other room and find it.
No, wait, hold on. Okay, so from 1987, self-titled, what year was it?
Yeah, it was probably 1986 or 7. Yeah.
Self-titled funny. Rosie Flores.
Yeah.
Everybody has to go listen to this record and picture Tracy on a game show. Raising the funds for this record. Okay, so how far does this go? Because from my understanding, your first gig at a like a major company in the industry was EMI, right? So where does that fall in the timeline?
Oh no, well, you know, I was working. See, I was still in LA, and I was working. I think I was working for a small publishing company. Then I was just, you know, I was managing, but I was doing all these part time jobs because I didn't make any money managing. You know, there was no money to be made, so I was kind of working part time. Then I got a job at a small publishing company, and they told me I could go ahead and manage Rosie. But I have to tell you, at the time, the man who owned the small publishing company, he was trying to get his daughter and his girlfriend deals, and I got a deal for Rosie before either his daughter or girlfriend. And then I got made to have the choice. They got mad, and it's like, well, you can either stay here or you can keep managing. And I went bye-bye, and I kept managing. And then I went to work for EMI in LA.
Wait, but how do you get the gig for EMI?
I don't remember. I was a good, you know, I was a song plugger. I had a good thing for songs, and I knew, you know, I don't remember how I got it. I honestly don't remember how I got it, but I got this job, and it was my first song plugging job, you know, and, a year later my husband and I both decided that we needed to be, it was really me. I decided we needed to move to Nashville. Emmy actually had moved first and was like pinging me all the time that I needed to move there. And I just felt like, this is right before Garth Brooks. I just felt like Nashville, I had this gut feeling that Nashville was going to explode, that that's where we needed to be. And my husband was flying there all the time. So I just said, let's go. Let's do the 2-year plan. And at the time, EMI had gone through a regime change, and they literally were going in. The new heads were going in and like firing everybody. And I was ready to get fired. And they came in and I said, listen, I'm going to save you. I'm going to move to Nashville. So, and they started laughing. I go, what's so funny? They go, we were actually going to ask you if you would move to Nashville. We know you love that music. We want to keep you. And I went, will you pay for my move? And they said, yes. So I got my move paid for. And there I went to Nashville. And that was in 88.
And then how long were you at EMI before you went to Sony afterwards, right?
Oh, like 2 years, maybe a year. And then Paul Worley, who actually produced, I met him because he was producing at the end. He was producing some sides on Rosie, and I met him. And then he had gone, he was a big producer, you know, produced the Dixie Chicks, you know, Paul Worley, and he was great. And he had gone to Sony ATV Tree at the time and to run their creative department. And he called me and said, do you want to come over here? I know, you know, I love working with you. And I went, yeah. And I was actually the first woman song plugger. They had never had a woman song plugger. So there was me and five guys, and there I, you know, and it was funny, and I loved it there. As I was there for about 7 years.
For 7 years. And then, okay, so then what is the, so you're there for 7 years. Is that the longest you've been at a major company? So I guess how long were you at Warner Chappell? for.
Oh God, yeah. I've had, you know, I've worked at a lot of places, and sometimes not for very long. Yeah, I was there for about 7 or 8 years, and I have to say, I mean, Donna Hilly, who's no longer with us, was one of my mentors, who was just a legend, and I just at what that point I just felt like I wanted to try A&R. You know, that was I was doing A&R because I would find things, but on the publishing end. And she was so supportive. And the first job I took, Roy Wunsch, who ran CBS Records at the time, was CBS before it was Sony. And he started one of the first independent record labels and asked me to come over and do A&R. And I just felt like, how fun a challenge, an independent. Because, you know, there was no independent labels. And it was just, it was myself and he and the two principals. And we had this kind of band of misfits. And started there. And that, you know, unfortunately, they were underfunded. They did it as a public company, but they really underfunded. I don't think they realize how much it takes to start to break artists.
Did you feel like, because I'm from New York, which is, you know, not really similar to LA, but let's just go with it for a second. I've always felt a little bit like an insider outsider in the sense of I have a great love of country music, but like I'm a New Yorker. Like there's, you know, as much as you don't want to think those things matter, I think they do. For coming from LA, I mean, what were you accepted right away? Now you're Tracy Gershon, but was it easy out of the gate?
Let me tell you, I say this. I was a Jewish girl from LA in 1988 in Nashville, Tennessee. It's very different.
You were a vegetarian also.
Oh, well, this is and I'll tell you why I got accepted. The fact that my husband was a steel player, but Harlan Howard, the legendary Harlan Howard, you know, songwriter, you know, Tiger by the Tail, I Fall to Pieces. I mean, legendary. He and I bonded because I got him a Katie Lang cut when I was living in LA. And when I brought Rosie Flores to Nashville for this time, first time looking for songs, Rosie and Harlan and I went out to dinner and we bonded. Like, I mean, he was just my guy. And so when I moved to Nashville, he made calls to like the old Yo team and said, this girl loves country music, take care of her. And because I really had a respect. Again, I was listening to stuff from the 50s and 60s. I could talk probably more about Lefty Frizzell and Merle Haggard and, you know, all these things. You know, I knew my stuff. And when I first went to EMI, I'll never forget this. Max Barnes, a famous writer, was one of our writers, and he wanted to meet with the new song clugger. And I come walking in with my little black motorcycle jacket, my black LA skirt. And I come in and he looks at me and then he looks at the receptionist and says, well, she don't look like no country song bugger. And then I had to talk to him and then I just won him over. But Harlan says you're good. And I really think that Harlan opened up the doors and said, it's okay. Because back then, I think that everyone felt like the people from LA or New York looked down on people from the South. And they might've been right, you know, and I kept having to convince people. I moved here on my own. I love the South. I love this music, but there was always a little bit of skepticism. But the fact that I had two names, Harlan Howard and Emmylou Harris, who were very credible, said she's okay. I think that really helped me.
That was enough. Do you think I go deep into the music that I love of country from the 50s and 60s and 70s, and I'm a total out. You know, in New York, I had to track this stuff down. Nobody was feeding me this. I had no, you know, this wasn't around what I was listening to. But I was just so fascinated by it. And then the people who I know who are Nashville people who maybe grew up in more traditional southern states, a lot of my friends don't really know beyond the 20s, maybe going into the 90s, but not really beyond past that. Is it because we're not from the South that we have such an interest in the older country music?
I you know, that's a good question, because even when I was looking for songs for Rosie and we were going to publishing companies and we wanted some of the old, I mean, we wanted the old, we were kind of doing more of a retro record. A lot of the pluggers, you know, they didn't even know that what they had. I mean, when I first went to EMI, this is another great story. I had no friends here. Everybody, my husband went on the road a week after I got here. So I was at EMI and I would just go through all the old, and it was reel to reel tapes. And I mean, I was just, and nobody knew this stuff. And I would make cassettes and say, this song's great. And in fact, Mark Bright, the famous Mark Bright producer, was our tape room guy at the time. And I used to, you know, the tapes would break and he was in the tape room. He'd come back and the next day and there'd be this stack of tapes that were all broken. And he came in one day and he goes, listen, you need to get some friends. You need to get a life, because I'd be in there till like 11 o'clock at night listening and breaking the tapes that he'd have to fix. But I was always, it was funny, but nobody really knows. There's not very many people who know that back catalog, and there's rich, wonderful songs. Like I know the, I mean, now I don't remember it, but I went through the entire Dolly Parton Velvet Apple catalog. That's got some great stuff in her and Porter, and some great stuff and great songs in there. And I don't think those songs, you know, I don't know. They're just, I think at one time they're, I don't say use form, but people were cutting things like that. But the music has changed so much. I just don't know that they translate. But, you know, somebody's going to come along, a Dwight Yoakam, another Randy Travis is going to want real traditional. And there's those songs are there.
It's going to. Yeah. Okay, wait. I want to go back to this list for a second. So, okay, you sent me this list just before the podcast. The fourth album on this list, and again, this might not be in any particular order, but these are the five that came to your head. Willie Nelson, Redhead Stranger, which I have a very interesting relationship with, but I want to hear your, I want to hear what you think, why this album, I mean, this is such an iconic album, but I want to hear your thoughts on it, and I've got some thoughts of my
honestly,
own.
Honestly, I have to say, it's kind of anything, you know, that was more, because you caught me so off guard, and I just did that because I could remember that title, because anything, it was more about the artist. It wasn't about the album, and there's something on it, it was, you know, Willie Nelson. I mean, come on, a touchstone of country.
That's his
country.
Album. If there's an album to recommend by Willie, that's the iconic album.
Yeah, so that's like I think really why I did, because I like other, well, you know, song, you know, to me, I
okay,
and sometimes
me,
I forget what songs are on what records sometimes.
I've never understood the appeal of this album. Now I get the iconic nature of it. To me, it is such a slow record.
Yeah,
and very minimalist. I've never gone into this record.
You know, you're not the only one, and some people go, that's not my favorite Willie, and I would have to say I threw that out. Maybe it's because you put me on the spot and I was just, and you're like, oh, he, you know, gave me 5 minutes and I couldn't remember some of the other titles of the records of Willie. That's why I said,
but no, but Loretta these Lynch. Are, these are the first that came to your head. That says something, I think.
Yeah. I have to go in and you can cut this out or whatever, but you asked me that and I came with, and again, the typical, I said, Loretta Lynn. I mean, here's the things, George Jones, you need to listen to George Jones, Loretta Lynn. I had a thing and, you know, Emmy Lou and all this, because I used to always say in any musical genre, you have to know where you've been to know where you're going. And I do believe that in when you're in a genre, you need to know the history. And I used to do that with, you know, even with, you know, Miranda Lambert, going back to her, we'd sit there and talk about, you know, Merle. And I love that she knew. And I would turn her on to some stuff. And she'd, you know, we talked about the history of country music. Now, I think it's very different, because it used to be that when you said you were a country music fan, that's what you listened to. That's really the genre you listened to. And now it's so different, because people don't listen in genres anymore. You don't, you can be, if you're listening to Maren Morris, you probably like Rihanna.
Right.
You know, it's just, there used to be like, you had a lane and most people chose a lane and they'd be like, oh yeah, I listen to R&B. Well, I listen to country, and they'd be like in secret. That doesn't exist. So I don't even know if I had the same answers. Like now, if I was doing A&R and somebody said, what record should I listen to? I might be completely different. You know what I mean? Because you're not listening.
Right.
It's not even the historical. I still think you always should know history of anything, but the genre thing is, you know, soon we're not going to even be thinking about genres, because we're already not starting to, because of the way music is being delivered and the way we consume music.
But I think that's I was talking with Seth Godin last week on this podcast, and he was talking about how the importance of genres to actually put you in a box, that the creativity comes from actually being in a box and figuring out, what can I do creatively in this box? I like that there is a genre of country, and the people who are brilliant are the ones who are taking the genre, like Kacey Musgraves, and saying, this is my take on country. It's totally different. If you take away the walls of genre, I don't know if it lands the same way, or everything kind of feels a little confusing. I think actually being in a box of a genre is where the creativity can happen with it.
Right. But I also think, yeah, true. But I also think that artists aren't listening. You know, 10 years ago, if you asked Randy Travis, he couldn't name probably one pop artist. He didn't listen that way.
Right, right.
So now, you know, you've got all these artists who are listening to other things. So that's infiltrating what their, you know, their influences are. I mean, there was that classic story of, you know, Randy Travis being told he was on the pop charts, and he was like, get me off, you know, he's like, I didn't even know.
Okay. I put down, okay. So I made this list also. So I think, and this is a modern album from the last 20 years, but to me, this album is really a turning point for the modern sound of country. This is Crash My Party by Luke Bryan, which I think really represents where country is now today. So whatever you think about that record, if you want to understand the format, to me, that is a record that everybody has to listen to if you haven't already. If you're coming in just now to the industry, I think you have to listen to that Luke Bryan record to really understand where the industry is today.
Probably the start of bro country.
Probably the start. I think it is. And there are a couple others, but for me, that's my record. Okay, wait. And there's so much else I want to talk about, but I want to do one more. Because Live at Folsom Prison, I can't tell you how many times I've listened to this record. Obviously, probably one of the most iconic country albums of all time. Mm-hmm. But why this record? I mean, this is the record. This is like, songs on this are incredible. Like, what's this? This one's incredible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's Johnny Cash. I mean, it's, again, I look at
I'm pulling
the thing
up the song list here. I mean, yeah, the songs are just unbelievable on this.
Sometimes I don't remember what's, like, I get my records, my albums confused.
Okay, so this has got like 25 minutes to go, which to me is an upbeat song. That's probably one of the saddest things ever about a prison inmate who has 25 inmates minutes before they execute him. This has got Cocaine Blues, one of the most wild. I mean, come on, this is the record, right? This is the record to listen to.
And just, and I think that's also, I get, you know, the fact that he went back to prison and recorded this live and the irreverence and how it was done. And, you know, again, it's just Johnny freaking Cash.
This is the one where he's not a character of himself.
No.
This is kind of peak. This is it. This is the record. Where he's peak performance. It doesn't get any better than this. Okay, so what are you working on right now? Because I tried to follow your career, and there's so much going on that's unbelievable. So you're starting a publishing company right now, or you're running a publishing company right now.
Yeah.
Tell me about the publishing company.
Okay. I have a joint venture with Universal Music with this wonderful person named Brandi Carlile.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so her and I have a little a company called Northern Lights Music. It's very boutique. We have, as of right now, we haven't even announced it yet. Ashley Ray, Sean McConnell, and Tanya Tucker signed to our company. It's our company is going to be celebrating diversity, activism. It's kind of wrapped. It's a little, you know, we want to super serve, very boutique. We don't want it to be big. You know, it's not the straight ahead, probably commercial country writers, you know, that you'd think of. These all have just a really unique point of view. And that's, you know, that's kind of where Brandi and I, you know, she said, let's the island of misfit toys, you know, I'm like, that's, but I think we just, you know, she's such a nurturer, and, you know, we've worked together. We've been friends, but we wanted to work together, and we're very like-minded in our, you know, again, in our activism, which is probably the most important thing I do now these days. And she, everything she does touches activism and celebrating diversity and, you know, supporting women. So we're trying to do a company that kind of, you know, wraps around that, and, you know, and we've got a lot of stuff. We just sponsored a songwriting camp for women of color who we really, you know, with some of the biggest songwriters in town, just so we can help, you know, bring them into the community that they deserve to be in. And it's been great. And she's fully supportive, and Universal's a great partner. So there's that. And I do have a consulting company.
Wait, so hold on to stay on that for 1 second. So when you're working with like someone like Tanya, who's like a legend, her career is just, I mean, especially in the past couple of years, what's happened with her career is just incredible to have seen. What's it like working with someone like her versus someone like Sean? So is she writing new material, or is it more kind of like estate management and managing back catalog?
She will be writing, you know, remember, this all started right at the pandemic. So this company is started with the pandemic. So, you know, none of us have been together. And Tanya's a storyteller. She's got, you know, you just around Tanya and it's a song, and that's how While I'm Living, or, you know, the big Grammy winning song on her last record was written because she had this idea, and she went to when she was making the record with Brandi and the twins, you know, Phil and Tim Hansroth, wrote around this idea, and so that will be the next record as well, because Tanya has a story to tell, and Brandy's great at taking somebody's story and putting it to music and words, and you know, she's really, you know, she was a big believer. Tanya was such a big hero to her. And she's like, you know, she had called me one time and said, hey, I want to produce Tanya Tucker. I mean, I think Shooter Jennings was already doing it. And Brandy's like, I've got to get in on this, because that was her hero. She said that, you know, Tanya Tucker was the person when Brandy was young and loved country music, but Tanya was tough and Brandy really related to her. And yeah, it's great to see them together, you know, and Tanya will tell the story. She didn't even know who Brandi was, you know, it was a lot. It was not in her comfort zone.
So how did she approach, how does that happen? How did she approach her? Or how did she get in? How did Brandy convince Tanya that she was someone who she should let produce
her? I think it had to come through Shooter, and then they got together, and I think it she warmed her up. Listen,
think on the outside, we always think that for someone like Brandy, who's so famous, you know, it's like you pick up the phone, you're in, boom, it's done, it's easy.
No.
So it was, she kind of had to make it happen.
Yeah. And, you know, listen, Brandy Clark, I work with Brandy Clark too. Brandy Carlisle is one of those people. I said, it's a good thing she's a good person because she could make anybody drink the Kool-Aid. You just want it. She makes you believe. And because it comes from a very authentic place, you know, okay, I'm going. And I think it took a while because, you know, Tanya didn't know from Brandy Carlisle. She knew Shooter Jennings because she knew Waylon. She'd known Shooter since he was a kid. And Shooter was a co-producer on Brandy's last record. So there was a relationship there and they work really well together. You know, he produced that record with Dave Cobb. So yeah, but it took her, you know, Brandy will say, Tanya wasn't like, oh, is this Brandy? Like I did an interview with Tanya Tucker on my radio show and Tanya was saying, I don't know who this Brandy was and who is this Brandy, you know, and now she loves her, you know, because Brandy will stay in there. Brandy doesn't have an ego. Like, what do you mean she doesn't know who I am? That makes her work even harder.
It doesn't matter. And then what is Sean up to? Is there anything we can talk about? Because Sean's got an amazing new project that I saw live like last year whenever we were seeing concerts.
Oh, the record.
Live.
Yeah.
Unbelievable project. Like what's happened? So like, what's it like working with someone like him? Like what's the day to day?
Well, he, you know, I worked with him. I signed him when I was at Rounder Records as an artist, and I'd worked with him at Warner Chappell. I didn't sign him. Alicia Pruitt signed him, and he became one of my favorite writers when I was at Warner Chappell. And then when I went over to Rounder, I signed him to a record deal. And then when I started this publishing company, I always keep in, you know, when I work with you, you've got me for life, and we wanted to work together again. And he is just this creative human being, and he's just, you know, he wrote The Daughters for Little Big Town. He can write anything. He's had number ones. He's written for Meatloaf. He can, you know, he's just so, he's just genreless, but he's just making this great music. And he just released his record and he's producing a lot now. I think he's just one of, you know, next year, ask me about him. He's great in the studio. He's got his own studio now and he's just creating all the time. And he's in the middle of producing Ashley Ray's next record. He produced her last record too. So they're both in my camp and they're just these creative, wonderful, wonderful, you know, creative beings, but wonderful human beings. That's really my mantra. I just want to work with wonderful human beings.
Okay. So we've got this publishing company, mm-hmm. which has not really had a formal announcement. So this might be an exclusive. This is exclusive.
This could be. That's the first
here.
Time I'm talking about. We've been this kind of under the radar. Yeah. Cause we've got some other people we're trying to sign and we're going to wait.
Under the radar. If we need to cut it out, we'll cut it out. Whatever.
It's fine. It's fine.
It's fine. It's fine. Whatever. You knew me for 2 seconds that you were telling about the publishing company.
Northern
Lights
Music.
Can't be that secretive.
For a year. Yeah. It's, you know, and so we're just going to make our formal announcement. Sometimes it's nice to fly under the radar though. You know what I mean? We're just kind of doing our work
and not
making any splashy announcement or whatever.
No, I totally get it. Okay, so the publishing company, what else can we talk about? Because I know there's a million things you're plugged into. You're the chair of the Recording Academy for Nashville, if
I'm
not that
the
correct.
Chair, I'm a trustee. I'm a trustee. Yeah. And then I'm very involved with the Recording Academy. I have been for years. I really believe in that and all the work they do. You know, I'm proud of, I
who
am.
Who plans the Nashville Country Grammy performance? How does that come together? Do they put that together? Are you?
That's a television. No, that's the television committee and the director and that's CBS. I mean, it's the network, you know,
that's it. It's the network thing. Yeah. So what does that mean to represent Nashville for the Recording Academy?
Well, I mean, we have an amazing board. You know, all these major, you know, cities have boards. And as a trustee, I help bring I represent our members and I represent our board into what we call the big room, which is all the other trustees. And we make a lot of decisions and policy and changes. And it's a really active board. It's not run by just the CEO. It's run by a board. And this board is amazing. I mean, you've got like people like John Legend on the board. You know, it's creators. That's what's so great about the Grammys. It's really full of creators. And, you know, the voters are creators. And, you know, when you get a Grammy, it's because your peer voted on you. You know, a lot of the other award shows, it doesn't take much to become a voting member. You know, if I do Zach's hair, I can be, you know, a voting Somebody's member. And that's fine. You know, that's, it's different. That's why the Grammys are different. It's a peer voted award, but you know, they do so much great things between Music Cares and their education, their advocacy. So I've just been a member of the, you know, this board for like, since I was in the music business. I really believe in it.
How cool. Okay. So I cut you off. So the recording,
I need to
Academy
talk about the things that I love. Yeah.
Well, go.
Change the conversation. So
we have to talk about change the conversation.
There's two things. Like I said, I really felt, so in 2014, myself, Beverly Keel, and Leslie Fram got together because we realized and we knew that there was a real problem in country music with women. I've always worked, for some reason, I've worked with men too. I've always worked with women, and I was managing, I still do, a woman named Natalie Stovall. And I will tell you this, she had a great buzz on her, and a label head who's no longer there had said to me, wow, your artist has such a great buzz. And I said, yeah, I know, why don't you sign her? Because she was out of her deal. He said, oh, I'm not signing women. Women just don't work. I can't sign any women. I felt like, I say this, I had a hairball. Like I couldn't even, something was coming up and I couldn't talk. And at the same time, Leslie Fram had been in town, and she was like, where are all the women? What's going on? And Beverly Keel, who's a journalist and over at MTSU, had written an article, where are the women on country radio? And
right,
we all got together and just said, something's up. And we started, we kind of got together. We got about 30 people together, men, some men. Well, there was really one man there, but managers and agents, and said, here's a problem. Let's not just have a wine and bitch fest. Let's do something about it. And we realized back then that there was just this, you know, it was this cycle where labels weren't signing women because they said radio wasn't playing them. And radio wasn't playing, they weren't getting enough women. And publishers weren't signing women because they didn't have an outlet for their songs.
Right,
and then booking
right.
It was so the cycle, and it was ridiculous. And especially when you have, you know, most, you know, the population is mostly women, and women are a big part of listening to country music. So we knew we had to do some things to change. And one of the things I think we really did is, when you're told, when you're a woman and you're told that there's only one slot at a label, it makes you very competitive. And we got a lot of the women. One of our first meetings, we had Kelsey Ballerini, who was making her first record, and we had Lauren Elena and Mickey Guyton and everybody. And we're like, listen, if you guys don't support each other, nothing will work. So a win for one is a win for others. And I think we really helped galvanize and develop this community. And it's been great. I mean, we still have a long way to go. And then, so, you know, change the conversation is, you know, we, again, it was kind of before Time's Up and Me Too, and we were ahead of our times, and we're still doing the work. And then last year, after the George Floyd murder, about six of us, we co-founded Nashville Music Equality, which talks about social injustice and, you know, and it really in community and racial bias in our own community. And that's just been really educating for me and great. And I just feel like stuff, you really can work, you really can make a difference if you start in it on a local level, you know,
right.
You want to go big, but it's a local level. And we have a lot of work to do. So there's,
I love
two.
On the, I love on the Change the Conversation website. It's just a giant tomato, of course, reflecting the tomato gate,
which
situation,
you know, happened after Change the Conversation. Everyone thinks that that's why we got our logo, because we, you know, we had about two meetings that changed the conversation. And then it was fine, you know, a few people. And then the day we had this one meeting, I'll never forget, this one programmer, for people who don't know, put in an article and said, if you really want to improve your ratings at radio, here's what you do. I look at my programming like a salad. The men are the lettuce and the substance, and the women are just the decoration and the tomatoes. And that came out the day we had one of our meetings, and I tell people, we could have levitated the room. The meeting was over at CAA, and they were so pissed. And I looked at Leslie and Beverly. I said, you know, we had a little Kindle going, but this just threw a gasoline. And the next thing you know, our thing blew up. And then that's what we used as our logo. And I called the programmer who said that. I actually talked to him. I said, well, thank you. Just gave us a logo.
Okay. Was your approach with this, like one approach, let's say, to really look at the data? Because I know like people were saying that male acts were selling more beer than women acts, and you were like show me the data. And then you were like, look, the data's it's basically even.
Well,
like,
was that
your approach with it a little bit?
Well, I think our approach was like, we can't just say it and whine about it. We've got to get some data, and we've got to do some work, you know, and just not be an emotional thing about it. And one of the, you know, we had a couple agents. I think one of our agents, Abby at William Morris, we were just kind of going around saying, hey, what are your issues? And she said, you know, my club owners will say to me, I don't want to book women because they don't sell as much alcohol. You know, the truth is, it's not about the act. It's about how much alcohol you can sell.
Right, of course.
You know, my first response was, well, they don't hang out with my friends because we can drink a lot. And then I just said, do me a favor, have, you know, one of your friends at one of these clubs pull receipts from this woman and this man that are kind of at equal level. And she had him do it. And he was surprised. He went, wow, there's not that much different. You know, maybe there was more wine. The receipts weren't that much different. So he even was like buying into this fallacy. And so I said, see, these are the kind of things we've got to break. There's just false, you know, we buy into this, that women don't want to hear other women. You know, that was the thing, is that was happening. Radio, well, women don't want to hear other women. Where are you hearing that from? You know, women don't want to hear other women because they're not hearing them on the radio. So they don't know that they, you know. And so right. That's a thing. And we still have a long way to go. But that was just so frustrating for all of us. And I know frustrating because I think women are making amazing music. And, you know, I think that they are held to a higher standard, that their music has to almost be better than the guys. Because I think I do say that guys sometimes can get away with mediocre songs and they still, you know, somehow get played. And I think women have just more substance right now. And I think they're held to a different standard. And we're, you know, that's just not right.
Do you think... It feels like, especially within the past year, it feels like there is more of a spotlight on this issue, that more people are getting shots. Do you think that's actually true? Do you think that's driven kind of in the media? And do you think that's really the reality that's being reflected? Where, of course, there's a long way to go, but where do you think this problem or this issue stands right now?
Well, I think we can look about, even when I say change the conversation, we looked at the labels and there was no more than like two women signed to each label. There was not. And now you look, there's a lot more signed. And right. Look, labels are a business. If they don't feel like they can make money, you know, it's, you know, they can like artists all they want. They still have to make money. And I think they were just thinking, are we going to, you know, who are we going to make money on, which is fine. And I think that, yeah, there's still, if you look at radio charts and some of the DSPs, it's better, but it's not by much. It's not why there's no parity. And, you know, music is, look, here's the problem, is music's subjective. You can say, I love that. You know, it's not like, you know, I mean, and I used to say, just because you're a woman doesn't mean you should be on the radio either. You got to make great music. But I've had arguments with some radio programmers and stuff who said, well, you know, that's just not a great song. And I'm like, that's in the eye of the beholder. I can point to some songs that are top of the charts that aren't great songs. Maybe they're hits. But, you know, it's because you're playing him. And some of these songs that never got a shot, you know, because I think people are easy to say, well, it's a female, it's not going to work. You know, we gave it a shot. You know, we played it in overnights. I don't know. You know, I just think I'm a song person. I don't know. I used to say this song, for sure, if it's a great song, means it's a hit. I don't think that there's too many other factors now that go into it. But I do know great songs. And I knew there's some females who are just putting out some great songs and are not getting what they're just due on those songs.
That's all. I don't care who sings it. I don't care about it. I just care if the song is good. It doesn't make any difference to me.
Yeah.
A male could have sang the Casey Musgraves record, and if it sounded like that, I probably still would have liked it, and vice versa.
But,
it doesn't make any difference to me.
You do this own, like, I remember Leslie Fram was telling me she was talking to these two women from, it was a CMA Awards. I can't remember. She was talking to them, and she said, who are your favorite artists? They named, like, six, you know, the top guys. And then she said, what about, and she named like three or four females, and they looked and they said, we don't know about that. And what Leslie realized, she goes, because she's not here, they're not hearing them on radio. That's what they're listening at. They're listening to what they hear. So that's what they like. And if you don't, you know, again, if I only give you chocolate ice cream all the time and never vanilla, you don't know that you like vanilla, you know, because you don't have it. And that's a bad analogy. I don't want to call anybody vanilla.
Right. If you've never tried gefilte fish, how do you know? How do you know if you like it? This is why I feel the need to try it once every 5 years.
That's true.
Okay, we're running out of time, but I still want to talk about a couple different things. So how involved were you with the High Women project? Were you involved with this at all? Because I've heard you talk a little bit about it.
I mean, I would say because of Brandy, I'm involved, and I was involved in the concept, and I certainly, I was in the studio and got my first tattoo that says High Women.
Is that
and
what that was is?
Yes, there it is.
That says High Women. How great
is that?
This
is High Women.
Who convinces you to get a tattoo? I don't have any tattoos.
No, because I'm in the studio and I'm late. I always love tattoos, but I'm just too lazy to go down and get one. And I think it was one of Marin or one of them brought in a tattoo artist. No, it was probably Amanda, brought in her tattoo person, and everybody was going to get high women tattoos. Jason Isabel was there. And I'm literally sitting on the couch and the tattoo artist is right there. And she goes, "You want one?" I went, "Okay." And I just put out my arm while I was there talking and I got my tattoo. It was that easy. You know, I just said to Jason Isabel, I go, "Where should I get it so it doesn't hurt?" He goes, "Right there, right where." He goes, "That's good."
I always think if I get a tattoo, I'm going to have so much regret. Any regrets?
Not at all.
You don't think about it. It's iconic.
No, because I also had a little, and I also have, you know, I did have one that I had designed and I wanted to do it. My kids talked me out of it. They were all upset. And of course, they're both completely tattooed. And I was like, double standard. But they were younger then. They were like, "No, you can't have a tattoo, Mom." So I was like, okay. So yeah, you know, I liked it because I liked it. It's not just the album. It's High Women. I liked what it represented. And it meant, you know, I mean, you never know. I might have a Zach put on my neck. You know, they all have Zach right here on my neck.
We'll get matching tattoos.
Yeah.
We'll do it. Yeah. Okay, wait. And then how did you sign Doug Seegers, who is an artist I know very well? Didn't you sign
Doug
him to
Seegers?
Rounder?
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Didn't you sign him to Rounder, who has an amazing story that still is probably not being told to the degree that it should be?
So
how did you find Doug Seegers?
Buddy Miller, you know, the famous Buddy Miller, the wonderful Buddy Miller, who's a dear friend, calls me at like 10 o'clock at night and says, "Hey, what are you doing?" I'm at home. And he goes, "You need to go to the studio tomorrow." Now, he never does it. I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "There's this guy you need to see." He tells me the story that, you know, I go, "Are you producing him?" He goes, "No, I'm just playing on this record." He tells me the story that he played with this guy a long time ago, but he knew him as Duke. And somebody kept calling and saying, "You should play on this Doug Seegers record." And long story, he finds out it's Duke. I walk and I go, "Buddy, if you're going to make this call, I'm going to the studio." I walk in the studio. This guy is in there and I feel like it's Hank Sr. again. I'm just like, oh my gosh. I was so taken by him. And here's his story. So Doug Seegers had been homeless for 15 years. He lived on the streets under the bridge in Nashville, you know, and a woman named Jill Johnson, who's from Sweden, she's a pop artist, and she had a show called Jill's Veranda. And she was doing some show on street musicians in Nashville. She was over here. I think she called a couple shelters or whatever, and she called this one shelter and said, "I'm looking at, you know, street musicians or whatever." And they said, "You need to go meet Doug Seeger." Her and her film crew, where does he live? He's under the bridge. Jill and her little one-person film crew go down under the bridge. He says, "Let me play you a song." He plays a song, "Down by the River." She's so taken by it. She takes him into the Johnny Cash studio. They record a duet. It goes number one in Sweden. He becomes known as Cinderella Man. And I sign the rights to the U.S. record. And there's a lot big story to that. But I just, and you know, it's funny because at the time, you know, in the world we live in, everything is about data. Oh, how many socials? What's your Facebook numbers? Are you on TikTok? You know, it's all that. And so even at Rounder, and all labels do it, they had something called a digital health check and you had to fill it out and fill out all the stats. And I just wrote F. And they're like, and the finance people or whatever making decisions call me back. They go, "What's this?" I go, "He's been homeless for 15 years. Sometimes he has his teeth in, sometimes he doesn't. He's 63 years old. He doesn't even own a computer." He gets an F on his, I said, "I think he might have a cell phone." It's not about that. And I was really grateful they let me sign it because it was a big risk for them. But the music was so compelling. And right now I think there's a documentary being done about him. And
there's a documentary. There's another film being done about him. And I was just talking with his manager last week.
Yeah.
They have a new album.
Yeah.
There's a new album that they're getting ready to release. He's an amazing project. I hope the world falls in love with him. Sweden has fallen in love with him.
Oh my God. Well, he's just amazing. And you know, he still goes down. He'll busk, you know, he'll do a big concert and then he feels more comfortable busking. He'll just go down there and put it, you know, he's just,
I saw him the other night, a couple nights ago, the American Legion.
Oh yeah. I wish I'd known him. Yeah. You got to call me next time. I'll go with you.
I will. Okay. Wait, we're running out of time fast, but we have to finish this list. So there's two more records here. Swing Doors, Merle Haggard. Incredible record. Why
Come
this
on,
record?
Merle Haggard. Well, again, this is one of the, you know, to me, it's like, you need to give me more time next time so I can really think about
this. No, but this is fast. This is what comes to your mind fast.
It was more about the artist. I wasn't even thinking about the album. It was just like, Merle Haggard, come on. Merle Haggard, you know? And I will tell you, in my lifetime, I'm going to just say this. This has been great. I got to meet Merle Haggard because of Sony Tree. And I have a really funny story about Merle Haggard. We don't have time about that now. And I got to work Buck Owens. I got to have a conversation with Buck Owens on the phone because I used to work his catalog. It's funny because I had the flu and I was on the phone in the back room. And my husband goes, "What are you doing at back there?" I go, "Oh, talking to Buck Owens." He goes, "Talking to Buck Owens. Aren't you sick?" I go, "Well, I was, but God, I got that adrenaline rush. I feel great now." And then I got to meet, again, Johnny Cash, you know, because of Carlene Carter, who was like one of my best friends when I first moved here. So I've really, you know, been, when I sit there and go, oh, these legends. But anyway, Merle, I was just, Merle Haggard, come on.
The voice is incredible. Chills. It's always, I feel like I'm always blown away when I listen to Merle Haggard that like some guy actually sounded like that. It's the most insane voice.
Yeah.
It's insane. And then the songs. Okay. Merle Haggard. Okay. Sweetheart of the Rodeo. The Flying Burrito Brothers, but isn't this by the Birds, if I'm not mistaken?
Did I say Flying Burrito Brothers when I did? I meant Birds, yeah.
The Birds.
Sorry. I wrote Flying, you know, I was just doing, you know, again, when you asked me and I'm...
Fast. Yeah. We're not holding against you. The Birds, this record is also an incredible record.
Yeah. In fact, I'm looking at the poster. My daughter, talk about tattoos. Uh-oh. That's what she has on her forearm because
Sweethearts
it's homage
of the Rodeo.
It's homage to my husband, really, because one of his pivotal records as a steel guitar player, you know.
This record is, I mean, this to me is like where, like, this goes to the Eagles. This goes to, this is such a
everything.
Base of the family tree. This is an amazing record also.
And you find, Zach, it's funny, and I love talking to you because you're one of the few that kind of has these historical, like you said, there's not, you can walk up and down Music Row and half these records people haven't heard. Or haven't, you know, listened to or know.
These are the records you have to, okay, so I put down, for the rest of my list, I put down Storms of Life, Randy Travis.
Yes. I got to
which,
work with Randy.
Which really is the record that
created,
you know, that's the record. To me, one of my all-time favorite country records this time, Dwight Yoakam.
Uh-huh.
An amazing.
Did I have Dwight on there? Yeah. Yeah.
You had Dwight on there. Yes. Yeah, of course. And then for me, the ultimate modern country record from the last 20 years, and then this is maybe going to be controversial, but I have American Saturday Night, Brad Paisley. To me, is the perfect mixture of rock and country with incredible musicianship, incredible songwriting, very approachable if you're not
Brad's
a country
great.
Music fan.
And let's not forget also record. Vince Gill. I forget to put Vince has made some great
but
records.
I don't know. What, yeah.
You know what I think is what I love, and it's like when you say Storms of Life, and when you talk about all these records, one thing that they have in common are songs.
They're song-driven.
The song driven. They're songs. They're not about it. They're songs. You know, obviously great guitar. There's always a great guitar playing. Like when you talk about play, that's the, you know, main thing, but you know, but the songs. Songs. You know.
Does Vince Gill have a great album front to back? Cause the singles are amazing and he's got so many albums. Is there a definitive Vince Gill album that stands out?
I'd have to think. I mean,
I think the one that has Liza Jane on it, I'm going to look this up. I mean, the one with When Love Finds You.
Yeah. See, you know, again, this is where you're getting me because sometimes I don't remember, like right now, sometimes I'll go, oh, was that song on this record or this record? Because now I listen and not in terms of, I'm bad. I'm listening online, you know, I'm listening and I'm not listening on terms of albums. So it's word of God. Sometimes I don't remember what song was on. I'll get them confused.
I'm looking at this right now. Guitar. I'm trying to find the album that, Pocket Full of Gold. To me, that's probably the Vince Gill album. It's got I Quit.
And I think I say, listen, Vince, I just remember, again, I have this story when I was in LA and Vince Gill, you know, he kind of, we hung in the same group and I knew him before he got his record deal. And I remember he was so depressed because he couldn't. And I just started learning about Nashville and country. And he's like, I'll never get a record deal. I'm not kidding. And I was like, and I heard his demos because his first manager, Mary Martin, was a friend of mine. And I heard all his demos and I remember going, Vince, if they don't give you, if that, those people in Nashville don't give you a record deal, something's really wrong. Because I just loved, you know, he came from, you know, he just had an amazing singer and I heard his guitar playing. And, you know, I think that, you know, they always told him he didn't have the songs. And then, of course, he went to another label stories, you know.
Joe Galante dropped him. I had Joe Galante on the podcast telling this story.
Yeah.
That he was signed with RCA and it didn't work and he had no idea what to do with it.
You know, sometimes, listen, sometimes that's the same thing with Patti Loveless. She found another, you know, everybody changes labels sometimes. It's not, you know, sometimes you're just where you're supposed to be. And sometimes that gives you even more, I think it gave Vince a little more fire. Like, really? You don't think I have the songs? Here you go. You know, I think, I mean, Vince is just the, I don't know, he's one of my favorite people. I've known him for so long and he just really is inspiring. But I know what you mean. It's like, I don't know if that he has that pivotal record. Like when we talk about, you know, Sweethearts of the Rodeo or, huh?
I think it might be Pocket Full of Gold now that yeah. I think about it, but I don't know if it is. He's much more of a singles guy. I think of the songs. It's the collection of songs with him
right.
than right. a specific album. Tracy, we have covered so much here. What have we left out? Have we left anything out? We've left everything out. We have
We've
to bring
left
you back.
So much out.
We have to bring you back for a part two.
Okay, what are we going to eat for our next? what food what item are we going to talk about our
what
next?
What are we going to eat? What's the next food item? Whatever Allie Harnell force feeds us to eat, that's what we're going to talk about. What's happening right now with Nally Stovall, and what is she up to? Because she's doing so much. She's hosting the Opry.
Well,
every
Runaway
Saturday
June.
Night. She's with Runaway June, of course.
Yeah, she's with Runaway June that my dear friend Fletcher Foster is managing. That was
right,
great. That was giving my adoptive child up to my.
How does she get into
friends.
Runaway June? Was that just kind of a natural thing?
Yeah,
obviously, they lost a member and she was such a great fit.
She had worked with Jennifer Wayne. This is a funny story. When we were on a label, Jennifer Wayne was our promotion person. So Jennifer firsthand knew Natalie's work ethic and loved her, and it was a natural fit. And we had talked about, you know, Natalie's an amazing musician, amazing front person, and it was hard. She had fronted her own band, but it was a natural step. And then, you know, now she's doing hosting on the Opry. She hosts Southern Weekends for Circle TV. She's just Nally Stovall is a people are going to know about her. She's an amazing musician, an amazing singer, work ethic like I've never seen before, and a kind, wonderful human being.
Can I
plug my radio show too before
we go? And I want to talk about the radio show too. So, okay. Yeah, okay. This is tell us about the show because this is such a cool concept to me.
Okay. So it's called Y'all Together Now. It's on the Beatles channel on Sirius, and it basically is interviewing Americana and country artists and how, you know, their influences by the Beatles and what the Beatles meant to them. And then they do they do a Beatles song. That's it.
What have you learned from this? Have you learned anything surprising about someone's connection to the Beatles?
Oh, well, I had Rodney Crowell's great. He had bought John Lennon's suit and he's, you know, there's some stories, you know, obvious. I've had the obvious ones like John and Martina McBride. They've got Blackbird Studios. They're the biggest Beatles fans. Margot Price. I had Margot Price on. She knows so much about the Beatles, her and her husband. You know, sometimes it's surprising. I'm trying to think. There's every once in a while, you know, I liked Charlie Worsham. I haven't aired his show yet, but he just talks about in his contract. He's got, what is it? There's a guitar, a certain guitar that kind of was influenced by the Beatles that they're going to buy. I can't remember which guitar it is now that they have to, you know, after he sells a certain amount of records that he gets, Warner's will buy him. So there's just weird
this
things like
in
that.
In his contract?
They have
to buy
put it
him
in his contract. Yeah.
They have to buy him. Some
yeah.
Kind
a certain
of
guitar. Yeah.
A Rickenbacker maybe, or a,
yeah, I can't remember what it was. I can't, you know, you're catching me at 4 o'clock on a Friday. So
do you have to find this show live? Because I was going through the SiriusXM app and I was trying to find the archives, but I couldn't find the archives. So you have to, when is this there? How do people listen to this?
Yeah. They play it. They'll, when I turn it in, then they'll give me dates and they play it like for four, you know, it's funny. They'll play it. They'll give me some dates and then they randomly play it. And I don't know. So I'll send you links. How's that? You know, but it should be, I'll ask them about the archives because they should do, you know, they should have
they
that
should
in the archives.
They should be on the archives. Follow yeah. Tracy Gershon on social media to see when her next SiriusXM show is going to be out and to keep up with everything else she's doing. She's managing. She's running a publishing company. She's running some incredible movements. Change the Conversation. This new movement that she's telling us about right now. Tell me again what it's called. The one...
Nashville Music Equality.
Nashville Music Equality.
But I will say to anyone listening, go support your women. Go support those
go
women.
Go support your women.
Go support the women.
How can you do know. That? How is you have to sign more women. You have to work more women. You have to give everyone an equal shot.
Listen to women on the radio. Go buy, you know, download, you know, listen to them on Spotify. Be aware that there's some great women out there. I mean, listen, they're great. I'm not saying listen to stuff. It's bad. But, you know, as far as labels are signing, they are. They're signing more women. You know, radio needs to put them in a bigger rotation, needs to play more women. I think, you know, we're making some moves. You know, we're getting there. you know, because they're, you know, think about all the new women out there right now. It's crazy.
No, it feels like there are a ton, right? Especially there are a ton of young women right now who are getting signed. And I think we're still going to see if they get their singles sent to radio or what's happening.
But I mean, Gabby Barrett just broke some records. Alex Klein, who's a producer, by the way, and a songwriter on the Tennille Arts. And we're all like celebrating. It's the first time a woman producer has a number one. That's crazy right there. So there's a lot of women producing right now. They just, you know what? They just never felt that they were welcome. They never thought that. It's like they never thought there's certain jobs or careers that I think, you know, men will stay away from and women will stay away from. And they just have to know that it's all open to them. And if they want to do it, they can. And that they're supported. I think that's the most, you know, you don't look at somebody, and go, oh, you're a producer. You know, it's like Rosie Flores, going back to Rosie Flores. She was a great guitar player. And you know what people would say? Wow, she's a great guitar player for a girl. And it used to, I'd go, no, take that last part out. She's a great guitar player, not for a girl. You know, and that's the thing. And that's what we have to remember. I guess that's what I want to close with. So. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Tracy, it is always a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time. Have we done? Have we left anything out now?
We don't have time and you're going to have to cut this and it's fine. We'll just, you know, part two.
We're going to cut it. We're going to move it around. We have to bring you back for a part two. We didn't even cover 25%. I had so many notes here. We didn't even get to half of them. There was so much to talk about.
Well, you know what we'll do is we'll go to lunch and then we'll figure out, okay, what's our next thing? And we'll edit ourselves because I think we have a hard time with that. We just want to talk.
We'll edit. This is going to be great though. Thank you for taking the time. We have to get lunch again. I was invited last time you guys were at Allie's.
I know. We were there. We're talking about you.
We're there. I missed the window to come. We'll have to come again. I don't know. We'll find a time.
There you have it. Tracy Gershon on the podcast. I think we could have probably done two or three of these. I had so much written down that I wanted to talk about, and I don't think we got to half of it. But thanks for tuning in. Thanks to Tracy for coming onto the show. And look, I want to tell you something, which is, you know, this show, we could not do it alone. The Zach Kuhn Show is brought to you by the American Songwriter Podcast Network. And we're proud to be part of this network. And you know, there's some really great shows in this network, actually, that, you know, I listen to a lot of shows in this network. Specifically, there's a show, Surviving the Music Industry, which I listen to weekly because that's what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to survive the music industry. You know what I mean? I'm trying to make it happen. Anyway, look, I got to tell you something else, which is the Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. And if you want more content from us, if you're like, this was so great, I cannot get enough, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. I think that's it. Is that it? That's it. That's all I got. Okay, listen to me. We're going to see you next week. Thanks for tuning in today. Thanks to Tracy for coming onto the show. Goodbye.